to the Just Space podcast, where we elevate collective voices and experiences to co-produce spaces that reflect inclusive and just values. We're your co-hosts, Dr. Dion Nastakasari, Dr. Eka Permanasari, and Amal Bare.
Our guest today is Dr. Nika Lemons. She is a human rights scholar practitioner. She describes herself as her ancestors' wildest dreams and humbly honors those whose shoulders she stands upon. Dr. Lemons draws strength and inspiration from three primary sources: her maternal grandfather, her mother, and her son. Having spent her formative years in 53206, America's most incarcerated zip code per capita, she set out to understand her community's conditions as well as build models for resilience. This passion led Nika to become a lifelong social impact accelerator, scholar, and tech inventor. She attributes her early motivation to wanting to liberate her community kinsmen and family members. Her scholar work is epitomized in her dissertation, which 1. Evidences the U.S. is committing genocide by attrition against African Americans. It is the first and only three-level analysis which utilizes the United Nations framework of analysis. 2. Demonstrates the role of spatiality or urban planning in creating internment and entrapment camps or ghettos. And 3. The founding state's ideological goal to create a permanent racialized proletariat to extract and hoard capital. Genocide as a means to a capital accumulation end. After becoming a mother to a Black boy in America, she forced her fear to take a backseat and accelerated her commitment to transforming the world to be safer, hoping her son, like all Black mothers, has the opportunity to experience the fullness of his wings unimpeded by race. Her lived experience and navigation in executive spaces as the only one has informed the founding of her tech startup, Just Society's technologies, and architecture of her tech tools, which function to 1. Preserve the state stability, 2. Mitigate human rights violations, and 3. Protect the indiscriminate access to the American dreams by advancing inclusive resilience and prosperity. So Dr. Nika Lemons and I met in graduate school at the University of Texas at Arlington. We shared lots of stories together. I guess growing up in graduate school. But we reconnected, and it is such a pleasure to be able to speak with you today.
Yes, thank you, dear. Thank you so much for inviting me. Thanks for always being an advocate of space and human rights. We've always shared that commonality of what the built environment means for not just quality of life, but life trajectory. And so we've always bonded on that. And so I've always just been a fan of your work as well.
We had the chance to read some of your writing, including your PhD dissertation, where you used the term genocide by attrition to describe the condition of African descendants of American slavery, or ADAS. For listeners who may not be familiar with this framework, how do you define it, and what led you to apply the United Nations framework of analysis for atrocity crimes to urban planning contexts?
Sure. So genocide by attrition is not a new definition for genocide. What genocide by attrition does is draws our attention to the process. Genocide is often, the literature is often dominated by the time intensive conflict. We think of the Holocaust, we think of Rwanda. And so the concept of genocide remains constant. Genocide by attrition deals more with what are the indirect and slow forms of annihilation which lead to the death of a group. It looks more at the composite of the calculated steps that are intentional, yet slow and usually undetected. And so this was largely developed in the last 15, 20 years or so. And if I were to read something equivalent to some of the definition, I really bring up Rosenberg, who wrote a lot in like 2012, and Wakeham, who wrote a lot in 2021. But a snippet just states that the methods of genocide by attrition describe state or non-state policies and practices which deprive individuals of specific set of human rights, such as policies and practices. They do not cause the immediate death of an individual or group, but rather lead to a slow and steady death of the annihilation of the group. So it's not a new definition. It doesn't replace genocide. It instead draws attention to the prominent role of indirect methods of annihilation. And it just offers as a name to explain group destruction that's too frequently dismissed because the literature is dominated by the time and tense. Your second part inquiry was more around the United Nations framework and maybe what was my motivation or interest for applying it. So I'm a bit of a dreamer and a kid that has always had ADHD, and I think about my mentors in the past, and they would say, I'm not sure if she's a preacher, teacher, doctor, or lawyer. And so I'm good at putting pieces together, right? So I will scan the whole world to make sense of this thing. I will fixate on something until it actually makes sense. And so one of my masters is in African American, African diaspora studies, and the other one is in international affairs. And so, in terms of the African American, African diaspora masters, I studied a lot on human development. And with the international public policy degree, I focused a lot on state responsibility and program evaluation. And so, having spent, and even in my bachelor's, I studied race and ethnic studies, having spent a lot of time learning, examining, trying to make sense of the atrocity committed against my people, racism never sufficed. Racism never really captured the essence of the experience. Specifically among African Americans, because the grander scope of the African diaspora, that to me is another conversation. But I could never make peace with racism sufficing, because racism is just the act and the notions. But the conditions of my people was never accurately captured to me. And so, having studied or examined some stuff around genocide and other human rights violations, I was very curious if genocide was the case. And so I'd encountered past efforts to discuss or frame the Black experience as genocide, one being We Charge Genocide, which was written in 1953, and the book is usually near me. And this was submitted in the early 50s by a collective group, which consisted of W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and William Patterson. And it never seemed to get enough coverage to me. And I looked at the organization of the book and how it explained or outlined the condition of African Americans during that period. And because the United Nations at the time did not have the capacity to investigate, that writing was kind of pushed to the side. And then a second writing surfaced in around 1966, 67 by Malcolm X in partnership with John Henry Clark. John Henry Clark is one of my favorite African American scholars. One of his quotes that always remains with me is, and I won't do it justice, but time is psychological catharsis for the Negro. If he knows where he has been, he knows where he must go. But history and culture tell people how great they have been and that they can be great again. And so to find out that he wrote the second, and it wasn't finished because Malcolm X was assassinated, intrigued me a bit. Like, you have this great Africanist and one of the most prolific activists in African American history working together to remove the argument around the Black experience from civil rights to human rights, and he's assassinated. I said, whew. And so I'll be honest, I was like, I don't know if I want to write that. I mean, if this is getting people assassinated. And so what made me revisit this was, one, the framework had been updated in, I want to say, 2010, 2011, or 12. And this was the first time more language to evaluate the real presence and evidence and definition of genocide to be measured was formalized by the United Nations. And so I said, I reviewed it. And I said, no, this is exactly what's going on. And so it felt very overwhelming to consider even attempting to apply it, because the 10 risk factors are serious convictions, the serious notions to bring forth as violations that the state is committing against a people. And then each risk factor has anywhere from 10 to 16 indicators. And so the framework states that you don't have to have all of the indicators, but the presence of all risk factors demonstrates that the phenomena is present. And so at first glance, I was like, oh, absolutely. Yes. So there started the journey, which meant the coding and tagging of more than 6,000 documents over the course from 1968 to 2020. And I chuckle when I think about my chair. She said, Nika, we can turn this into a book series, or you can graduate. So I'm going to need you to minimize this a little bit. I'm indebted to Dr. Maria Cosio for her patience and her commitment to this work. But again, I set out to just make sense of the life experience of my people, because racism wasn't enough. Discrimination wasn't enough. It felt like we were talking about the pieces, but not stating that there was a car or that there's an airplane. We were describing the facets of something, but not what the phenomenon is. And so that's what motivated me to apply the framework.
Wow, so fascinating, Nika. Thank you so much for sharing that. Now we understand that, as you mentioned, racism is not enough. So you need a bigger picture to capture this. And I would like to return to our previous question, for instance. Now you mentioned about, and you are also argue that systems of provision within the state apparatus, including the legal system, public policy bodies and planning institution functions as mechanism of containment and violence, yeah, for this genocide by attrition.
Did
Now,
I say that? No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
oh, you really scared me there.
I
Now, can you please walk us through how you see planning institution operating as tools of this attrition? Perhaps with some examples, and what are the special implications of this? Thank you.
So to make this journey of a puzzle, of a big picture clarity, meant that the theory framing this construct needed to make not just make sense, but I had to hunt down the construct that could explain the phenomenon. And so a lot of this, a lot of the framing, the systems of provision comes straight from Marxism, as well as critical race theory. So whenever a state is examined, and this pulls from Althusser, there's an ideological apparatus. What is the spirit of a country that can be in your economic engine? It impacts your economic engine. It impacts how citizens see their everyday life. It impacts how you view the world, what you expect from your state. So, in the case of the US, because what it means in the case of the US for Native Americans or the indigenous population, what it means for immigrants, is all different. So imagine the state as a person looking at how we interact with a group of people, our perception, just like how we perceive perpetrator murderers versus teachers versus doctors. Everyone has a utility and a role and a level of respect and deference or aggression. So the state, what I presented is that the state defines itself as white in nature, culture, economy, and who is entitled to certain goods, respect, decency. It starts its whiteness and then everything else declines. This is the state as a person. This is who we are. This is how we see the world. This is how we show up. Everything else reduces as you get further from whiteness. The state as an economy, you can pick up. You almost have to see the economic engines as different tools. We can pick up a sledgehammer called capitalism that destroys things. It's just extractive. It can be communism. It can be whatever we decide. So the state I see as a person has picked up these tools and these perspectives. And this is how Althusser, this is my layman's explanation of the ideological apparatus as stated by Althusser. And so, in the case of the US, the proletariat in the US is intentionally created to be a permanent racialized group that cannot, they cannot escape their fate because you can't. The one drop rule means you're always black. So for that, we have associated these certain rights, conditions, perspective, and expectations and role for these people. So the creation of that then means, in this ideology, who I am, how I see the world, how the state operates, means that now my institutions, the repressive state apparatus, behaves consistent with my personality, my opinions, all of the things, right? If you're a communist government, then your functional institutions operate differently. If you're a welfare state, your functional institutions operate consistent with that. And the ideology and behavior patterns, personalities of your citizens reflect this same phenomenon. So your government has to follow suit with your ideology. If you see African Americans as humans and not second-class citizens, not a population that you once felt were subhuman, because it's one thing to be barbarians And because you can convert them. And that's what in the United States, that's our history of interacting with the indigenous population. We try to, train the savages and the barbarians. We try to, through Christianity, right? But that was not the approach with African descendants. They were subhuman. And so, because of that, how the state interacts and its institutions interacts is these wild beasts that have to be tamed, controlled, imprisoned, broken, all of these things. Your state functional institutions and its citizens and its governing and those who enter those institutions as executives who operate the state entities, police, judicial, legislation operate consistent with that to varying degree, right? You still have liberals who still have some notion of like white savior, right? And then you just have blatant racism and anti-blackness in some of your conservative parties. But what your question really gets to is that the ideology is reflected and is embodied in every aspect of the state. So those all function as systems of provision within a state, which seek to execute the intentions and perspectives in the ideology of the state, which is keep those things over there. And that is the role of planning, to keep those things and those subhumans over there. Exclude those things and those subhumans from us. Keep us protected from those things. Keep them away from us. They do not need decent things. They do not need certain goods. It is okay to inundate them with higher levels of pollutants and carcinogens and environmental degradation and insufficient clinics. They don't need parks. They don't need trees. They don't need, we need police with more, with heavier equipment to maintain them, maintain space between us and them. We need them policing those things at the borders to keep them from entering our area. So it's not, it's keep them in place and keep them in place spatially, but keep them in check as an in their place. Keep them over there. They are all systems of provision which reflect the ideological apparatus, state apparatus. So planning, I don't state it as a as an aggressor, this inanimate aggressor, but more like a tool of the state that reflects its ideological beliefs. So if you feel that those things or those people are subhuman and they're not safe and they are to be dominated and they are all of the things, then you need a tool to keep them away. And thus, you pick up the tool of urban planning.
Nika, thank you so much. There's so much to sit with there, and I have to say I am so grateful to be in conversation with you today. As you're talking and sharing your thoughts on the questions that we're asking you, there's so much that's resonating with me, and so much that is making me think. I'm taking notes, like I'm getting ready to write a paper on this. But yeah, thank you for giving us so much to sit with and to reflect on and to think about. And yeah, I really appreciate this conversation with you. So as I was reading your dissertation, which resonated very deeply with me, because I think there's some points of alignment and kind of extension and adjacency that come up in the research that you do through your dissertation and also in the work that I'm doing through my PhD research as in urban planning. So my work is historically grounded as well and critically examines the role of planning institutions in sustaining racialized geographies of harm. Like you, in my professional work, I've had about 11 years or so working with families and households that were and are affected by the work of the ways that planning institutions are used as tools to contain and entrap and deprive. And as a planner, I'm very interested in kind of figuring out through my work how do we find ways to more transparently hold those institutions and those tool holders accountable to the harms and the violence that they continue to perpetuate. So in my work, I explore how urban planning and public policy systems work in tandem to produce spatialities of difference, constructing environments of systemic neglect, material deprivation, and state-sanctioned vulnerability for some, while securing protection and prosperity and access for others. And this kind of re-emphasize, like it emphasizes what you just said about, and I thought that was just such a powerful, succinct way of putting it together. You know, keep those people or those things,
We'll
subhumans,
see
away over there.
over there.
And that is just a perfect little short sentence to kind of encapsulate all of that. And through my research, I argue that planning and urban policy making embed precarity into the everyday lives of low-income households and racialized neighborhoods. So I really appreciate the historical lens that you take because I think it's impossible to understand these systems and find a way to create a sense of visibility around what they are doing behind the scenes without bringing the historical lens to that understanding. But yeah, so I really appreciate that historical lens and your attention to the spatiotemporal dimensions of governance and the erasure of certain kinds of people and places as compared to other kinds of people and places. And recently, in my travels, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts and audiobooks, and I came across the work of Frank Wilderson III. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
I'm not
And
totally versed, but yeah, I'm familiar.
yeah, so it's very new to me. So I'm still sitting on some of the podcast episodes that I have come across listening to him being in conversation with other people, and by coming across him also kind of introduced me to the world of Afro-pessimism. And I felt like there was like a homecoming for me in terms of like thought and consciousness, and there was a piece of the puzzle that was delivered to me in terms of like finding a way to make sense of the ways that some of the frameworks and tools that I have been used to using in understanding some of these systems of harm production and reproduction have not been enough to be able to capture the fullness or the full scope of what is happening, what has happened, and what continues to be generated. And while I'm still in the early stages of kind of engaging with this framework, it's struck a familiar chord. And as someone from the African diaspora, with over a decade of experience again in the US housing system and now living between the US and the Netherlands and kind of seeing how these systems of violence show up differently and also in a lot of ways the same way across geographies, across continents, and how there's some sense of sharedness in the ways that we are treated and seen as existing outside of the human, right? The lesser than. So I often find myself kind of confronting the persistent embeddedness of anti-blackness, and Afro-pessimism has begun to offer me some language to be able to make sense of things in a bigger way than I have been able to in the past. Both being able to better articulate kind of the structural impossibility of repair within systems that are built to devalue Black life and other forms of life. So I would love to hear your thoughts around kind of some of the critical frameworks that you use in your work that have been useful to you and that have offered you a sense of home in terms of being able to deconstruct and represent the world as it is. And how you, as an individual coming from that community, being in that community, how are you navigating, as also a practitioner, kind of the tensions between the urgency to imagine otherwise and be hopeful, and perhaps hopefulness is not, it's not where you want to go or where you're at, and kind of the clarity that comes from naming the depth of the structural harm that we are living with and are trying to. As much as we're able to undo to a degree. That was a lot, so I apologize.
That was quite a bit. And my son is like, I don't know what he's doing. He's like barking and like doing some other stuff. So if I have to pause for a minute, just please bear with
That's
me.
okay.
That was a lot. So I am familiar with Afro-pessimism. I came across it when I was doing this work, and I too am enamored by the work. I won't say that I'm fully versed in it. I will say that I'm not fully versed in it, rather. I think it does a phenomenal job of disentangling anti-Blackness and its components. Like, my work looks at how the state shaped itself and envisioned itself for a means to an end. I think this work explains why it's enduring and why and how it was conceived in a way different from critical race theory, even though I know there's a relationship between the two. Critical race theory to me, and where this like begins and ends, looks at the state, and Afro-pessimism looks at the oppressed. And while they are complementary, there are some aspects that are quite distinct for Afro-pessimism. It is an ode to examining anti-Blackness, to me. That's my opinion. So, how have I coped, navigated this space? Therapy. I was absolutely depressed while writing this. It took me, I'm also a cancer survivor, and so there was some time where I just like had to deal with that challenge, and then I came back to this work, and I was absolutely depressed and concerned about my health while fighting cancer. It's tough to outline, improve the dehumanization of your people, and demonstrate its intentionality. It's devastating. And so, your question around the urgency to imagine otherwise and the clarity to name kind of like the depth and the texture of the harm. I had to write this as a dedication to my mom, to my grandfather, to my son. And I think of Zora Neale Hurston's quote, like, if you are silent about your pain, they will kill you and say you enjoyed it. And so I needed to figure this out because I needed to prepare my son, well, as he's coming of age. I didn't want to do just the talk that Black people do with their child. And so I needed to center him in something that articulates his existence and his responsibility to his people. And as even, I think it was last night or might have been the night before, we were talking about his temperament and how he goes to attend sometime for offenses. And I needed him to understand the importance of his sovereignty. He's a very sovereign child, but he's also a very principled child. And so he goes to attend in being upset. not because he can't control his temper, but he fundamentally does not like that you are violating principles, especially principles that he keeps articulating to you. So I've told you I don't like that. And I've told you that it bothers me. And I told you that it hurts my feelings. And I told you he was having a spat with a friend. And I told you that that's not polite. Why do you keep doing this? And so I needed to figure out this thing in order to, as I'm raising him, I need him to understand the bigger ecosystem that he exists within. So the need to write this was selfish, but it was also, it's a selfish aim that every single Black mother, not mothers of biracial kids, and I mean no offense to them, but of Black boys. And my son is brown. He's not light skinned. He's brown. And so there was this urgency to do that for the parent that I seek to be. But there's an urgency to do that so that when I speak in places and spaces and in places of power, that I'm speaking with a certain level of indisputable clarity, that I'm not talking about an antidote or a symptom of the bigger problem. I'm talking about dismantling and the problem of the house that is built. And the hate is seeping out the windows. So there was a sense of urgency that I needed for myself, that I need for my son, and that I need because of where I started to notice I was getting access to in terms of places of power. So that clarity allows me the ability to imagine otherwise. Because now that I can say with clarity, oh, we don't, it's not we need to stop racism. It's not that white folks need more training or undoing racism training. No. The state needs atonement. The state needs to go through all of the stages in order to reach atonement. Because in Rwanda, they had to go through all of the stages, and then you had to be repatriate. And so we talk about reparations with disconnected and disjointed from the bigger construct. And that's the problem. Because if you're just talking about slavery, you've missed the whole construct of how it is a measurable phenomenon of a human rights violation, which requires reparations. I mean, the US forced Germany to pay reparations to Holocaust survivors, as it is committing a more atrocious crime. And not only that, but the Germans or the Nazis, because I don't want to say that's the wrong term, the Nazis borrowed so much of the concept and construct from the US, from how the US structurally commits genocide by attrition against African Americans. The final result is because the statement for Nazis is that the US is taking too long. So I needed to prove this so that I can say we can be something different, because there are constructs all around or examples all around of genocide where it is different. Post the clear naming of the construct, post the state going through all of the processes to reach atonement. So we cannot talk about something different until we name what is going on. So that's where I exist in that space.
So you have meticulously documented, right, that connections between the past, present, and what can the future possibly looks like in your dissertation, and kind of just how you articulated a lot of that in these conversations. And I think it's a really important to highlight what you said about the planning as kind of a state apparatus, right? Because the planning as a discipline, as a practice that historically have contributed or maybe kind of become this tool
in, kind of what you argue as kind of genocide but attrition. So you called really for a radically new procedural paradigm in planning. And so what does that look like in practice, and how does it depart from a more conventional equity of reform base of planning approaches? If we take the idea that planning has been complicit in genocide by attrition, what are the ethical obligations of planners today?
So, what does it look like in practice? And how does it depart from equity or reform-based planning approaches? What I state is that the existing ones demonstrate epistemic incommensurability. That's just a fancy word for saying the ideology and the epistemology that informs planning theories is informed by capital redistribution and the process for decision making and elevating voices and power sharing. And that's not what planning has been used for. So, because planning has been used to execute genocide by attrition, then these things aren't able to reconcile. These type of any theories, planning theories that come out of this, aren't able to reconcile this thing. If your theory is based on capital accumulation, it solves redistributing capital. But that's not what the problem is. The problem is genocide by attrition, right? So all it's saying is that the existing theories are not equipped. So because of that very foundational epistemic incommensurability, it cannot solve. They cannot solve for that. And as a result, what is recommended is that there be a planning approach that is informed by genocide by attrition. So what happens then is the ethical obligations of planners has to also be informed by that. So, for example, AICPs, our obligations as planners state the list of our, I won't go over it, we all know it. But if it's informed by genocide by attrition, I don't know if you can hear my son's TV. Can you all hear it? No? Okay. I was going to be like, oh my gosh. What that means then is that part of the obligations, the legal requirements of a planner mean that I have to think about how certain actions need to be reported because of what how they contribute to this thing of genocide by attrition. So, for example, if placing a certain industry, pollutant industry in a community contributes to the overexposure of carcinogens to a certain community, and there's a pattern, it's not just environmental racism. I'm demonstrating, I need to know how it's going to, I need to present a report. And I need to demonstrate how this is aligned to contributing to the slow death and annihilation of a group of people, genocide by attrition. And so planners need to legally state that and file that somewhere. And so there needs to be a federal agency for that. In the dissertation, I outline a lot more of this. So what does it mean to create a federal department or agency? I think it made it into the dissertation. This may have been on the cut when she said, you got to get this 500 pages. When my chair said, you got to get this 500 pages down to at least 200. But that's the space of what changes the legal obligations and role of planners. You cannot continue to talk about planning in a space about capital accumulation. It's not about capital accumulation. You cannot talk about it from a space of I get to talk. A voice of it, because it's none of that is sufficient, because the real problem is this: genocide by attrition in the US case is inextricably linked to spatiality. And if that is the case, planners have to show up differently. Planners have to be required to adhere to certain legal obligations. There needs to be a reporting agency for planners to report to, unimpeded by any local jurisdiction or leaders. So that's where some of my imagination came. And that's where reimagining what is necessary to undo some of the structural harm caused. That's some of the conclusions of the writing.
Thanks so much, Nika, for bringing that ideas. We are all aware that you are also the founder of Azimu Group. Now, how does your consulting work reflect the political commitments of your scholarship? What kind of questions or tensions do you help your clients grapple with?
So I have two, well, three organizations, but the two main are Azimu Group, which is a consulting, and then Just Society Technologies, which is a tech startup that has produced, which is prototype for tech tools that specifically examine spatiality in terms of identifying this genocide by attrition and all other human rights violation and what's necessary to restore these communities, but also make them whole. And so, in the case of Zimu Group, in terms of our consulting arm, what I do there is largely about our clients may come in and identify their pro have an identified problem of practice. And oftentimes they skip spatiality. And so, place-based efforts are non-negotiable in our solutions to the problem of practice. And each position that I've had, I've always integrated spatiality. So when I've worked for TNTP, where I was the director of social and economic mobility, we were building an organizational construct on how we would restore or improve the educational space of the clients. In the organizational kind of like theory of action, I was sure to make sure that spatiality was included. And my role as the Deputy Chief of Operations for St. Louis Public School District, we were reimagining how to utilize or retrofit vacant buildings in order to solve the spatial-oriented problems of the students. This is 100% free and reduced lunch district, and it's also in a city that is the poster child for spatial containment. And I say that because I think St. Louis is the only city in America that does not belong to the county. So what that means is that county dollars don't go back to the city. It is the only city in America where a city is its own county. And so that's gerrymandering to the next level, right? And so, how I show up in these spaces, I'm very intentional about there's the organizational governance model. And then, and this is bringing in that stuff from the dissertation, like the ISA stuff, right? And then there's the service model, which is the RSA, how the ISA influences how you provide services to the client. And then the third thing that I bring in or I examine is how it shows up and should be differentiated in space. Because growing up in 53206 turned my light on in terms of awareness about how certain neighborhoods vastly work differently from other neighborhoods. And so I always bring that to the client. Your service model, your ISA has to be examined. Your RSA has to be examined. And then how it is differentiated according to location matters. We all know that now that location matters. Ras Chetty's work, Where's the Land of Opportunity, has demonstrated to us that location matters. It impacts life expectancy rate, quality of life, education, infant mortality rate. Location matters indisputably. So that's how I show up in these spaces. I immediately examine an organization's ISA. Its service model functions as the RSA, and my solutions are differentiated according to location.
Thank you so much, Nika. I appreciate the this practice space that you're in as well, and the ways that you're choosing to show up differently and in ways that often extend the space and opportunity for critique and invite the other to kind of walk along the way with you to be able to think and do their work differently in a way that transforms practice and brings about change. Yeah, I want to be mindful of time and respectful of the time that you're sharing with us. So I'll ask one more question and then we're ready to close. And I mean, we have a ton of other questions we want to ask, but to be respectful of you and your time. But maybe the last few minutes we'll have some time, and if there are any questions that you might have for us, I think this has been a bit like us kind of inundating you with questions. I think it would be nice if anything comes up to you that you would like to ask us, there's also time for that. We always like to end with a bit of on a positive note. It's been a very intense conversation, a very good and conversation that has left us a lot to take with us and sit with. But what in your daily life and in your practice, what kinds of stories and people and experiences, you know, close to home or even far from home, are giving you a source of hope and inspiration and energy that gets you that helps you to wake up the next day and keep on doing what it is that you're doing?
I am so post-therapy in terms of understanding the atrocity. I am daily inspired. I am inspired by my mother, who's still here. Like I said, she's a sharecropper from Mississippi. She's illiterate. She was never allowed to attend school. She was forced to stay on the farm, and she never learned to read or write. But that woman is snappy. And so, while it is a hashtag, rest is a revolutionary act, my mother has always, always found her peace. You will not disturb her peace. And my father, who's no longer with us, he would often say, "Baby, you're gonna learn to laugh at it, or you're gonna die crying about it." And so he would tell the most like obscene jokes about racism, like, everything from tires, how a man was stopped because he had black tires on the back and white tires on the front, and the police stopped him because it looked like a nigga chasing a white man, and he had to switch him, And so there are like all of these moments where you actually just have to laugh at him. I am so proud of my son. Oh, the way he articulates himself, and his preferences and his likes and his dislikes. And I'm not exempt. Mom, I'd rather not. Mom, I'd appreciate if you. And he's eight. So we're in the grocery store, and how much he owns his space and his voice. I've had men come up to me and just say, like, "Whoa, you're doing a really good job." And I said, "I fear I may have overprepared him." And he said, "But you didn't overprepare him for the world." And so I am intentional about finding like these small spaces of just pride and hope. What I am like, you can't keep black folks down. Like, we take pain and turn it into blues and made a whole genre. We take scraps and turn it into a whole fashion line. Like, we may not have enough money to go see XYZ or go and do, but we sit on the porch and we laugh. And so I am just so impressed and honored to be a part of a group that is impacted by an atrocity that has never been done in human history. There's nowhere you can look in human history and see the job done on African Americans that's been done anywhere else in the world. And yet we can still smile and be kind. We are not without flaws, but we can still laugh and be kind and make art out of the pain. And so I am just I whenever I get too low, I just go home. And yeah, we laugh. So my hope stays intact by staying connected to my family and my people.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Nika. That was beautiful,
Yeah.
beautifully articulated, and gave us a beautiful lens into your life and the people and the experiences and the moments that are giving you energy and life and love and care. Thank you for that.
Thank you for your time today. It was a pleasure to meet with you all, to chat with you all. And I look forward to any other opportunity to chat more and figure out other ways to make the world
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree with you. This is definitely, I hope that this is not the first and the last time that we're in conversation with you. I think this has
again.
been
Wow.
life-giving, and as I wrap up my Monday evening here, and I am so grateful to have had the chance to be in conversation with you and look forward to future opportunities to connect in any capacity possible.
Likewise. Take care.
This is a wrap for us. Until next time. Remember, together we can make a difference and create sustainable, equitable, and thriving communities for all. Thanks for listening, and until next time, this is Eka Permanasari, Dian Nostakasari, and Amal Bare signing off.